Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
We begin with the front runner, Mr. Trump. Your opening remarks.
Debates are stupid. You should be paying me. And Wolf Blitzer looks like Papa Smurf.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I think you're really gonna like the Hillary Clinton that my team and I have created for this debate. She's warm but strong, flawed yet perfect, relaxed but racing full speed toward the White House like the T-1000 from Terminator.
A little peek at tonight's debate from Saturday Night Live. We'll be talking about the debate, among other political hot topics, with New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd coming up. She has a new collection of her columns out now in book form. But first, Los Angeles right now is hot, literally and figuratively. It is a hot, bubbling cauldron of housing issues. The rent is too damn high. Homelessness is up. The real estate boom taking place from downtown to Koreatown to Hollywood has many middle or low-income people feeling left out. So, what's the answer? A November ballot measure called Build Better LA presents itself as one solution. It's one of a few housing initiatives voters will decide on between November and March. Anna Scott is a producer for Press Play. She's been reporting on Build Better LA, and she's here to tell us what exactly this measure would do. Hello.
Hello.
Well, what does it say it will do?
Okay. There's a lot going on here. So let me just boil it down to the basics. So this would apply to development projects that get special exemptions from the rules that exist, like if they want to be higher or denser than the rules allow. The idea is, hey, we should get something in return for that. So there's two components to it. One is a jobs component. And basically, when you boil it down to the big thing that would change, this would require that those projects that get these exemptions have majority union labor.
Mm-hmm.
It's worded in a specific way that I won't get into, but that's basically what it boils down to, 60% essentially union labor. And then the other piece of it is an affordable housing piece. That part would require that developers that get these exemptions either build some amount of affordable housing in their projects, or they pay a certain amount of money into an affordable housing trust fund that would then go to fund affordable housing somewhere else.
Doesn't that already happen in many of these cases?
It does already happen in a lot of cases. For the biggest projects, they often are using local union labor, and often the city will negotiate some element of affordable housing or a payment for affordable housing from developers that get these special exemptions. There's a sliver of projects, though, that are kind of the mid-sized, smallish apartment projects will probably be the most affected.
And is there a percentage of affordable housing in each project that this would require?
Not a hard and fast percentage. Basically, it's a sliding scale. So starting at about 5% minimum if you're building the units on site. Basically, the more affordable the units, the fewer of them you'd have to build.
Okay. Who's behind this and who supports it?
Primarily, it's the LA County Federation of Labor, which represents more than 300 unions, and affordable housing advocates. And they've teamed up on this.
And developers are against it?
Yes, not surprisingly, developers by and large are against it. They say that putting these additional burdens on developers will lead to less building. And here's one developer I talked to. His name is Mott Smith, making his case.
Adding burdens like this to the places where housing is just starting to get built could basically stop those areas from building. And so the more affluent people end up moving into apartments that lower income people are moving out of. And this is where you get gentrification.
So he's basically saying developers won't build, so there'll be less housing, less stock. driving up the prices of existing housing.
Right. And he's arguing that they specifically won't build in parts of the city like South LA or, say, Highland Park, places where the market rents still are reasonably affordable because those projects are hard to pencil out as it is. He's saying that with these extra burdens, they really won't build in those places. Then older housing stock will get more expensive as people move in, and that will lead to gentrification. Backers of the bill totally disagree with that. Here's Alan Greenlee. He's the executive director of the Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing.
I'm a big believer in development. It is the way out of our affordability crisis. I just think that we need to compel folks to build in a very specific way. We really feel like it's a break the glass kind of moment.
So he's saying that, look, there's plenty of money in these real estate deals. Developers are not going to stop building. We need to just squeeze out of them whatever affordability we can get.
So it sounds good from an affordability tenants' rights perspective. So do all people in that camp agree?
They do not. Uh-huh. In fact, kind of surprisingly, there's this split with different factions of affordable housing advocates. One person I talked to is Elizabeth Blaney, who's a tenants' rights activist based in Boyle Heights, and she is not for Build Better LA. And here's what she had to say.
The issue is that, one, there's no guarantee that it will actually put any affordable housing in because it has the option to contribute money into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. And in return for this, what the developer gets is an expedited process. And so that is a problem because that just expedites displacement and gentrification that's already happening in our neighborhood.
So she is basically saying that, one, there's no guarantee that there would be affordable units in any given development project because developers under this initiative would have the option of instead simply paying a fee into an affordable housing trust fund, which is a fund that's managed by the city and does fund affordable housing, but you don't know where that housing is going to end up or when it's going to be built. So the people who live immediately around the new developments wouldn't necessarily benefit. She also says there's no guarantee that these new affordable units would actually be accessible to people that live in neighborhoods like Boyle Heights. Because what's affordable is based on area median income in a place like LA County that's relatively high. Last year was something like $64,000 a year. For families making, say, $20,000 a year or even less, she says this really doesn't do anything specific to help them.
So an affordable apartment in one of these buildings would still be unaffordable for them.
Right. Now, like I said earlier, there is a sliding scale under this initiative. So there could be extremely low income apartments in some of these buildings, but just very few of them. It's not really clear exactly how this would all play out in the real world, but these are the arguments that are being made now.
So it sounds like the ramifications or the effects of this are pretty much unknown.
Yes. There's no way to predict the future, right? And you have two sides. Both of them say they want more affordable housing in the city. Both say they want to slow gentrification and keep housing affordable for most Angelenos. The proponents of it say that if Build Better LA had been in place 3 years ago, we would have 5,500 new affordable units built today. But then developers say that doesn't take into account the potential chilling effect. There hasn't been an independent, in-depth analysis of what could happen with this. So what we have are what the two sides are saying. That's the gamble of a ballot initiative.
All right, Anna Scott, producer for Press Play, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
And what do you think? Do you like the idea of Build Better LA? Is there a better way to create affordable housing? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Or you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. There's another development measure on the ballot, but this one is only for Beverly Hills voters. Measure HH, as it's called, is the subject of a bitter campaign with one side accusing the other of using illegal foreign contributions. And here to explain is Gene Mattis, senior media writer for Variety. Hi, Gene.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, let's begin with what Measure HH is.
Sure. So this is an initiative sponsored by the Beverly Hilton, which would allow it to build a 26-story condo tower on the southwest corner of the Hilton property on Santa Monica Boulevard, kind of on the western edge there of Beverly Hills.
Well, why are they putting this before the voters? Why don't they just go before the Planning Commission?
I suspect that they wouldn't get the answer they wanted from the Planning Commission and the City Council, and so they've decided to take it straight to the voters. I think this is sort of becoming a trend, actually, around California. You saw that with Inglewood did an initiative to approve the football stadium down there.
Right.
And it is, if you can get voter approval, it's a lot faster. You don't have to go through all the environmental work and go through the haggling with the planning commissioners and the city council members. So if you're successful, it is a lot cleaner for the developer, but you then sort of find yourself in a political campaign.
Right. And so who is sponsoring the opposition to this measure?
So the opposition is the Wanda Group, which has its own development plan for the parcel immediately to the west of the Beverly Hilton. So right across this little street called Merv Griffin Way, and right across that there's a big empty parcel that used to be a Robinson's May, and they want to build a big condo and hotel. And so they are opposing the Hilton project, and the Hilton is opposing the Wanda project. So you have two, you know, billionaires fighting it out.
Why is the Wanda Group opposing it? How does that affect their building?
You know, largely the argument I've heard is on process grounds that, hey, look, we're going through all the procedural things you have to do. We are going to the Planning Commission. We are going to the City Council. And we think the Hilton should have to do that as well. You know, basically, the Hilton is sort of launched their attack against Wanda first, and so it may be just mostly retaliation against that. But, you know, there may be some concern also that a 26-story building would cast shadows on the Wanda Hotel project and the luxury condos that they're building there. So maybe they have that concern as well.
And Wanda, that is a Chinese conglomerate?
Right. So Wanda in China is, you know, it's one of the biggest companies in China. And what they primarily do is malls and real estate and then theater chains. And they are now increasingly investing in the U.S. So they bought the AMC Theaters a couple years ago. And they recently bought Carmike Cinemas. So now they're going to be apparently the biggest cinema chain in the world. And they're also sort of making a foray into the production side on entertainment. They bought this company, Legendary Entertainment, earlier this year, and there has been speculation or talk that they might be interested in buying a minority stake in Paramount, although that seems to be off the table at the moment. But they're definitely a sort of growing presence in Hollywood, and you know, there's been talk that at some point they may want to acquire a major studio, which would make them obviously a very big deal.
Mm. Okay, so this is where the allegations of foreign campaign money is, where these allegations are coming in. Now, who's making these accusations?
Yeah, you'd think, well, if they're in a fight with the Hilton, maybe it'd probably be the Hilton that's making these allegations. In fact, it's the union that represents Hilton's employees, which is called Unite Here Local 11, a very powerful union in its own right. And they are the ones that have actually filed these complaints with the Federal Election Commission and the California Fair Political Practices Commission, alleging that Wanda is using foreign money in this ballot fight.
Any evidence that it is?
Well, so the laws on this, you have to look really closely at, you know, which entity is actually making the contribution. Is it, in fact, you know, the local domestic entity subsidiary of Wanda in China? If, in fact, it is the local subsidiary, that's okay. And if it's being directed by either U.S. citizens or foreign nationals who have green cards, then that's okay. But if it's being coordinated or directed by foreign nationals, then that is not okay.
And that's illegal.
You can get in trouble for that and get fined.
Right. Well, it's hard to untangle that, right, with multinationals who have lots of subsidiaries?
Well, yeah, and so the FPPC, for instance, can go and investigate and, you know, file subpoenas for emails and stuff like that and figure out who, in fact, is making the decision to make these contributions. The allegation from the union is that, you know, the buck stops ultimately with the chairman of the Wanda Group, who is a Chinese national. And, you know, if he's involved in making these decisions, you know, that's not okay. You're not allowed to have foreigners influencing domestic elections. That's just a tenet of federal and state election law. So it's a question of, is the FPPC going to go investigate that? Are they going to be able to prove that if there, in fact, is coordination from foreign nationals? And if so, obviously it wouldn't happen before the election, which is in November. It might be several years, in fact, before they get around to actually coming to some decision on that. But it's a serious allegation that needs to be looked at in order to determine whether there's any validity to it.
Well, it's also a good PR move if you're opposed to what Wanda is doing and you want this project to go through.
Right. And you know what's interesting, too, at the same time this is happening, there's also sort of increasing concern in Congress about growing Chinese interest in the entertainment industry and investments in the entertainment industry. And it's just exploding in the last year or so. There's just been just this rapid expansion of Chinese investment. And the concern on Capitol Hill for some folks, mostly the Republican side, is that this could pose some kind of strategic threat. And some members of Congress are looking to expand the authority to review these deals that Chinese companies are making. So there is this sort of broader concern around what we're allowing them to invest in. So I think that's, you know, an issue that sort of goes a little deeper than just a fight over, you know, how tall the towers can be in Beverly Hills.
Gene Mattis, he is senior media writer for Variety. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you.
And Beverly Hills residents, we want to hear from you. What do you think of Measure HH? Are you in favor? Are you opposed? What do you think of both development projects? Let us know your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, IMDb, the place for information on people who work in Hollywood. But is that information completely accurate? The gaming of IMDb, next on Press Play.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country, put your old ride to good use, and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Governor Jerry Brown signed legislation over the weekend that requires online databases like IMDb to remove an actor's age if the actor requests that. The authors of the law say it's designed to help prevent age discrimination. Well, many actors are just fed up with how IMDb works. Their pages on the website are a key component of the casting process, but it's not like LinkedIn. Actors do not have total control over what ends up on their IMDb pages. Here to tell us more is Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, let's first talk about this new law. We know age discrimination in Hollywood is a real thing, but why should publishing actors' ages be illegal? These are public figures. It's public information, right?
Yeah, that's the issue, and that's what the Internet Association, which was lobbied against this bill, was arguing. This is an effort to prevent factual information from being put onto the Internet. And that raises all kinds of First Amendment issues and other potential issues. But on the other side of the issue, what SAG-AFTRA, the Actors Guild, argued, and they were successful in, is they said this is very narrowly tailored to casting websites that are subscription-based, meaning IMDb Pro, Studio System, these websites that are databases, essentially, that play a very big role in who gets cast in what movie or what TV show. And they're saying that, you know, there's a caveat here. You have to be a member of those sites in order to request that your information be taken down. And that's what they argue is a big difference here. It's not a blanket. You cannot put an age on the Internet. It's that if a casting website has your age there and you are a member of that site, you can request that it be taken down and they have to comply.
So casting directors could find out the real age of an actor elsewhere.
They can, of course, but you know what the argument is they're not trying to prevent star ages from being on the Internet. You know, that information is out there. You can go to Wikipedia or whatever. Mm-hmm. They are trying to give a boost to an unknown actor or someone who's up and coming who may be trying to get that first break in Hollywood and a role that calls for a character who's 18 years old and this actor happens to be 25. And that information is not out there publicly on the Internet, but it is on this person's IMDb Pro account. And they want that person to have a shot at getting that role and not be what they say is discriminated against because they're 25.
And usually, is that a problem with female actresses?
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly a problem for actresses, although you've heard it in both contexts. The president of SAG-AFTRA, Gabrielle Carteris, starred for many years on Beverly Hills 90210, and she was much older than the high school students that they played on that show. And her argument is, with the advent of these databases and the extensive information that's out there, she may not have gotten that role. And that changed her life and her career.
Okay. Well, looking at the bigger picture then, how big a deal are these profiles on IMDb in getting jobs in the industry today?
They are a big deal. I mean, they are. You talk to actors and representatives and casting directors. They are a shorthand. If you're looking at an actor or an actress who's coming in, you look at their IMDb or their studio system profile and find out what they've done and find out, you know, who they are, where they're from, and you find out their age. And that what the Guild's argument is that is a piece of potentially discriminatory information that, you know, if it's not already out there elsewhere on the internet, is specifically coming from those IMDb pages that the actor doesn't have any control over. You hear stories all the time of representatives for actors who believe that their ages are incorrect on IMDb, and they're trying for years and years to get IMDb to change their age, and they won't do it because there's a presumption that people are lying, they're trying to be younger. I know of two particular actors who have complained to me. They say, you know, IMDb says I'm 34, I'm actually 32, but we can't get them to change it because they saw some article in a Canadian newspaper that said I was 34, and they're using that, and they think we're lying. And we've offered them to show them our birth certificate, and they say no. So this is SAG's effort to go around that and get a law, and Jerry Brown signed it.
So whether or not you pay your $20 a month as for the IMDb Pro subscription?
No, you have to be a member.
You have to
be a member, and you know, but a lot of these actors are, and then it becomes a contractual relationship that you have with IMDb.
Okay.
Meaning, if you sign their terms of service and you pay your money, you have a contractual relationship with IMDb, and based on that, you can request that it be taken down. That's how they argue they're getting around this First Amendment issue, is that it's not them trying to purge information from the internet per se. It's specifically tailored to sites that you have a contractual relationship with because you are a member.
Got it. All right. Let's talk about this star meter. So that's on regular IMDb and IMDb Pro. What is that? How important is it?
Well, star meter is this mysterious thing that IMDb has that takes into account, you know, the box office and the projects you're attached to and other things that comes up with a measure of your star value and bankability. And it is kind of the bane of representatives' existence because they don't quite know how it works and it's out of their control. And they see this star meter that pops up, and some people benefit from it, some don't, and people do look at it. I don't know how seriously people take it, but it is something that pops up on your profile. And then adding to the problem is there are these websites out there that claim to have the ability to manipulate your score and boost your star meter, which if that's true, then it would cause the entire system to be questioned, and actors just don't like it. It's just another example of how actors don't really have control over what's going on IMDb, which is a very big source of information for the people giving out jobs.
Well, just looking at it now, you look at the rating, the star meter rating, and Marion Cotillard is number one. And that would indicate to me it's just because she's been in the news during this Angelina Jolie Brad Pitt divorce story. Does it have
Absolutely.
Anything to do with her, you know, acting?
Yeah, who knows
ability
if Marion Cotillard is a bankable star, but she's been in a lot of headlines over the last week. So that's something that I think a lot of people would get upset about. You know, maybe not Marion Cotillard's representatives because they like that, but you know, it's not a real accurate representation of who is valuable as an actor. It just means someone's in the news.
So you could basically boost your star meter rating by just doing a search for an actor over and over again, and that would indicate interest in that actor?
I think it's a little more complicated than that. Obviously, we don't know the exact algorithm, but just
but that's
in
part
my,
of it.
My own anecdotal experience with looking at it, I think it's not just searches. I think it's also people who are in headlines, mm-hmm. people who are associated with particular movies. Like I know when Star Wars came out, the weeks, you know, in and around Star Wars, Daisy Ridley and John Boyega were at the top of the list because everybody was right. talking about Star Wars. Does that make them the most bankable actors in Hollywood? No, it helped, but it's, I don't think, you know, you're going to want to cast Daisy Ridley over someone like Jennifer Lawrence, you know?
Is there a better rating system?
That's the thing, is I don't think there is. And that's where this system kind of comes into fill a vacuum. You know, you hear there are these things called, you know, Q scores, and there are companies that produce these lists for overseas bankability when studios are looking at what kind of stars they want to put in movies for overseas appeal. They can look at these things, these models, and you see social media companies also putting out lists of people who have big social media profiles. But does that mean that you're a big star in a movie? I don't know. If that were the case, Kim Kardashian would be a giant movie star. So, you know, I don't think there is a perfect, you know, algorithm that can tell you who's a giant movie star.
All right, Matt Bellany, executive editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks so much.
No problem.
All right, we want to hear from you, actors and actresses. Are you on IMDb? Are you concerned about the star meter or the age on your profile? Let us know on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW. Press play. Coming up, New York Times star columnist Maureen Dowd on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and what to expect in tonight's debate.
She knows those issues cold. And he is proud of not knowing. I mean, I think it's not as much of a thrill for him if he prepares.
Maureen Dowd, next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The event we have all been waiting for, the first heavyweight battle between the presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, is taking place tonight. Well, for some insight into these two personalities, we turn now to Maureen Dowd. She's been covering them for two decades for her Pulitzer Prize-winning column in the New York Times. And now she has collected a lot of those columns, along with some new writing and a new book. It's called The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. Welcome to the program, Maureen Dowd.
Thanks, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, let's start with the Donald. And you have known him for a long time. Right? Since 1999?
Yeah, this whole campaign is like the revenge of the 90s. All these 90s characters are coming into view. I went out on one of his early forays in 99, where he was trying to figure out if he could run for president. And I said, you know, why on earth? He was this blinking white rapper, you know, a Batman figure in New York. And I said, why on earth would you think people would vote for you? And he said, because I got good ratings on Larry King.
And so he said that with a straight face.
Yes. And so it was the beginning for me of his ego arithmetic, as I call it. And then he goes, you know, with Melania, do you know how many men have hit on Melania? So everything was about the numbers. And that part of him has not changed at all.
Did you think
the politics have changed?
Yeah. Did you think back then this will never happen? He could never run for president and be taken seriously?
Yes, this is a really funny story, like about how long ago, maybe, would it be a year ago or right before this whole phenomenon got going? I'm a hoarder, so I looked around my office and I really needed to throw out some books or give them away. So I looked around and I thought, which of these figures are never coming back onto the public stage? So I ended up giving away all of the books by and about Donald Trump and all of the books by and about Newt Gingrich. So I am a really bad prognosticator.
Wow. Well, don't throw away
I've now had to buy all over again.
Don't throw away your Herman Cain books. That's all I can say.
999.
Well, so he is pretty much the same guy he was when you covered
him.
Well,
in
then.
Some ways, yeah. I mean, in that way, where his ideology is his ego. But in other ways, he's exactly the opposite, because he was sort of, you know, believed in abortion rights and gun control and all these other things that now, you know, he's sort of is a host body taken over by the alt-right.
Yeah. And he liked Hillary Clinton. He donated.
Yes.
To her.
Yes. He donated to her and the foundation, and she went to his wedding and Bill and he gave me all these quotes about how great she was. And Bill could not get into a golf course at that point because he was in bad odor because of the Mark Rich pardon and how they left the White House. So Trump was talking about how sad it was that a president couldn't get into a golf course. So he led him into his Westchester golf course and they began playing golf together and talking about girls. And I think they both cheat a little bit at golf. So they really liked each other and he really liked Hillary and admired her. But he's a very transactional figure. And once they were in the way of something he wanted, he had no compunction about trying to throw the worst stuff at them.
A lot of people have said that he didn't really want to be president, that he just did it to feed his ego or to, I don't know, just be a bigger television personality for it to benefit The Apprentice, what have you, or his brand, and that he was as surprised as anyone else that he actually won the nomination. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure I would agree with the part where he doesn't want to be president, because I don't think he wants to slink back to Fifth Avenue as a loser with a, you know, tarnished brand. But I think that he is the most surprised person on earth that he got as far as he did. And I thought he had a really sort of shocked look on his face at the debates, the primary debates. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just couldn't believe someone wasn't taking him apart.
Well, and you've covered the Bushes for a long time, and you have quite a long relationship with the elder George Bush, Poppy. And so tell us about that and how Jeb Bush was not up to the task of taking on Donald Trump from your perspective, from covering the Bushes for so long.
Yeah, I have a long essay that I worked really hard on, an original essay in the book about my 30 years covering this amazing father-son presidency and the Jeb campaign. And it's so fascinating that H.W. Bush came out this week and told Kathleen Kennedy Townsend that he was going to vote for Hillary. In one way, it's shocking, but another way, not, because I went down to have lunch with him in, I think, 2011, 2012. And it was right when Trump was doing all the birther stuff. And we started talking about that. And he just called Trump a really bad name and was completely dismissive of him while he was praising Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And I think he watched as Trump took apart Jeb on the debate stage. And he used to throw his shoe at the TV set whenever Trump came on the TV. I really think that that was painful for him because he had always wanted Jeb to run. He and Barbara had always wanted Jeb to be president. And, you know, then W was president. And then he really wanted to live to see Jeb be president. And so to watch him quickly dispatched in what Trump referred to with me as a, like, quick kill or one day kill or something, you know, with the nickname Low Energy, was, I'm sure, extremely painful for him.
And that it was so easy to do that. It just was that one phrase and it just stuck.
Right, because I'm not sure Jeb really had his heart in it. Part of it was he was rusty. He'd been off the national stage for a long time. And his parents really wanted him to run, but he did not seem to have his heart in it. And whatever else you say about Trump, he does have a bat-like sonar to get at people's weaknesses. you know? And so I think he sensed that Jeb's heart was not in this and sort of gave him his moniker.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Maureen Dowd, columnist for The New York Times, about her new book. It's called The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. You say that this is going back to the 90s. And for you, you also met Hillary Clinton in the 90s and have covered her off and on since then. When you first covered her and she was presenting her health plan to Congress, you write that you were pretty impressed by her. Right?
Yes, it's funny because some people who read the book ask me if I had a girl crush on her then, because I was a news reporter, but I was incredibly supportive when she was running as Bill's wife, because I know that first lady job is hard for women like Hillary and Michelle, who have the same educational credentials and job credentials as their husbands. So I was supportive of that. We went to dinner at this revolving restaurant in Kentucky, and we talked about it. And then when she became First Lady and was in control of healthcare, which was 16% of the government, I was a little dubious at first, because I was worried that people wouldn't have the nerve to tell the president's wife if she was messing up. But I put it all aside and I called her performance dazzling. And, you know, I said they were handling it perfectly. But then, as you know, that was the beginning of where we see this pattern with her that I think is very self-destructive, where she kind of builds this wall of secrecy and keeps the press out. And the healthcare thing was very secretive, and it was my way or the highway. So then that went down.
Mm. So when was it when you realized that she wasn't all that, that your girl crush was over?
No, I still think she's a very idealistic public servant who wants to save the world. That's a strong part of her. But sometimes she stays behind that wall of secrecy and people feel she's not leveling with them. So then they get confused. And so to me, I just wish she could kind of go back to that pure idealism of Wellesley a little bit and take away some of the scar tissue that causes her to make decisions from a place of paranoia.
Yeah, everyone says, oh, well, if you only knew Hillary Clinton the way we do, that she's funny in person.
Right. Well, that's a joke around our office, because we always say she's a hoot in private, because even recently some of you know, her friends said to me, well, if you could just sit down with her. But I know that. But, you know, it's weird in politics sometimes. You know, Al Gore had that same side where he could be really fun at dinner, too. But they can't integrate it into their public persona.
There's been a lot of talk, a lot of hand-wringing in this election over the press's role in covering these two candidates and over what's being called as false equivalents in the coverage of this campaign. The idea that Trump is being, as the president has said, being graded on a curve, and all the problems with the emails pale in comparison to all the stuff that he has done, and all the ethical lapses and, you know, the outright lying, at least when it comes to the birther issue. What do you say to that, to critics who say you are perpetuating this false equivalence that is really damaging?
Yeah, I know that Times readers sometimes get upset with me, but from the very beginning of my column, it is not an ideological column like all the other columns, because I was a political reporter for so long, so it doesn't come from the left or the right. What I think is that Trump does a lot of things that are worthy of reproach, and we have to reproach him. But that doesn't mean that Hillary is above reproach. And I think if we say we're going to give her a free pass, we're not going to say anything that she's doing that she shouldn't have done, like, you know, the email server, I think that hurts her and democracy and us. I just think everybody has to be held accountable.
What do you think is going to happen at the debate tonight? We've heard that she is preparing like crazy with her binders of information, and he probably is not preparing.
Right, because she's the queen of homework and he's the king of winging it, right? Yeah. And he's proudly boasted that he's not preparing. You know, I think that she is going to try and make him seem nuts. So she's working with psychologists, and they're going to try and come up with a few good men moment where Tom Cruise causes Jack Nicholson to lose it and start yelling, "You want me on that wall." And then he's going to try to make her seem sickly or something. So he'll probably come out with an industrial strength bottle of Purell, which he always carries around because he's afraid to shake hands. He's a germaphobe, or a hazmat suit or rubber gloves or something, and try and make her, or maybe he'll take her arm so she can't make it to the podium. So I think that's going to be the dynamic.
So again, it'll be a lot of theatrics rather than
debating
the issues per se.
Well, she will know the issues. You know, she came to the Times editorial board for her endorsement session, and she spent 25 minutes talking about CAFTA, and I had to go out afterwards and figure out what CAFTA was. I mean, she knows those issues cold. And he is proud of not knowing. I mean, I think it's not as much of a thrill for him if he prepares as if he wings it and somehow gets through it.
You don't think he's nervous secretly that he's again going to think, what am I doing up here? I don't belong here.
I'm sure he gets scared sometimes. I mean, look at what he is doing. He went from just kind of a party fixture in New York to even with Hillary Clinton in the polls. It's a crazy situation. I'm sure it's vertiginous for him. But he's a little bit of an emotional Buddhist, so he's always in the moment, trying to make the deal in the moment.
Wow. I mean, they couldn't be more opposite, right? She's
yes.
always got her eye on the future. He's always in the moment.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Except they both have foundation problems other
yeah.
than that.
There's that. Maybe there's more in common than we think.
Right.
Well, Maureen Dowd, it's been really fun. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, Madeline.
That's Maureen Dowd, columnist for The New York Times and author of the new book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. Coming up on this program, Snapchat sunglasses. You can record video with them and instantly upload to your story how Snap is trying to avoid the Google Glass embarrassment and how it's trying to change media as we know it. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, a lot of the fun to be had when it comes to debates happens on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat. Donald Trump's campaign even made a crooked Hillary filter for Snapchat. That's a frame that users can place over their pictures. But there's even bigger news in the Snapchat universe. Snapchat's parent company, Snap Inc., dropped a new product called Snapchat Spectacles. They're sunglasses that record video from the wearer's perspective and automatically upload the videos to Snapchat wirelessly. It's the company's first hardware product, a risky move, according to some analysts. Joining me now is Josh Constein. He's editor-at-large at TechCrunch. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first of all, describe these spectacles. What do they look like?
So they look sort of like Wayfair sunglasses, but a little bit more of rounded lenses. But what's really special about them is that in the corners, on one side, they have a lens which records up to 10 seconds of video at a time when you tap the sort of hinge of the sunglasses. And the other side has a light that will illuminate when you're recording so people know that you're taking video of them. They're going to cost $130. They'll come in black, sort of a reddish coral color and a bluish teal color, and they should be going on sale in limited supply later this fall.
So how do they differ from Google Glass?
So Google Glass was trying to be a whole computer on your face. And I think the futuristic design of them with this little prism glass box in the corner, and they didn't actually have normal lenses in them, it looked really weird. It was alarming. And they were trying to do lots of things because they were a screen as well. You could see things being projected on the Google Glass so the wearer could watch and respond to menus. But with Snapchat Spectacles, they're just a recording device. They just take video for up to 10 seconds. So hopefully they won't have the same kind of creepiness factor, and they look a little bit more similar to sunglasses we're ready for.
But still, it does raise those privacy concerns.
Absolutely. I think anytime people have something in their face that could suddenly be recording video, even if there's an obvious light that's going to go on for it to happen, people get a little worried. We're used to the idea that our phones live in our pockets or people's cameras aren't at the ready at every moment. So if you're doing something weird and you see someone raise up their camera or their phone, you could change your behavior in time to not get caught on camera. But with these, a quick tap and suddenly you're on video, and that could definitely alarm people. The lucky thing is that since Snapchat is known for disappearing content, the fact that most of what you record on Snapchat goes away in a day, it might make people a little bit more comfortable about being on them than, say, being recorded forever on a Google Glass.
Okay, but does it really go away? Sometimes it doesn't really go away because you can keep these Snapchats, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can still these Snapchats are going to be either they can be stored on the device until you're around your phone, or if your phone is with you, they'll instantly get shuttled over to your phone and put into the Snapchat Memories feature, which is basically like Snapchat's own camera roll. So yeah, you could export those potentially and do something different with them. We're not exactly sure on what the restrictions are going to be on the content, but it's certainly worrisome. And you know, with Google Glass, we saw signs going up at bars that said no Google Glass. We saw people get punched in the face over them. So I think Snapchat may be wading into an area it's not exactly ready for. Well, its younger teen users might not care. As soon as somebody wears these out in public, it could cause a problem.
Yeah. So why is it doing this? Snapchat is really, really successful as is. So why does it need to go into the hardware market with these glasses?
Snapchat wants to be the camera. It wants to own the entire recording experience, because as long as it's still mediating everything it does through the camera in your iPhone or your Android phone, it doesn't have that same control and it can't do all the things it wants to do. And so by owning the camera, it has a lot more control over that experience about what kind of field of vision you're recording in. So these spectacles, they actually record in circular video, which is unheard of. And basically what that means is when you watch it on your phone, you'll be able to rotate your phone in any direction and you'll still have full screen video. And they'll also be recording in 115 degree super widescreen format. So it'll be a little bit more like a fisheye, where you can see more than what you're used to in a normal camera. And that's going to give it a lot more of a sense of that you're life casting, that somebody else is getting a window into your life. And by doing this, Snapchat has a lot more control over its destiny, because one day we might not be using smartphones. We might just have wearable computers, and it wants to be ready for that.
Interesting. Well, it's sort of like a GoPro, I guess, but cheaper and more fun.
Yeah, you know, GoPros are known for being for extreme sports, but they're not something you would necessarily wear on your shoulder all day.
Yeah.
These are supposed to be something that you could feel comfortable breaking out at a barbecue or a music festival, and people wouldn't think you were really strange for wearing them. But you know, that's going to come down to how Snapchat markets these. Personally, I think it would be smart to not sell them publicly, but instead just give them to some celebrities, like people on the red carpet, you know, singers on stage with their band, and let people feel like they're the center of attention and get fawned over by adoring fans and paparazzi like these celebrities. That way, spectacles feel like something that's aspirational, that people want to buy, that it's cool. And that would be the opposite of the strategy that Google used, because when it released Google Glass, it didn't give them to celebrities or models. It gave them to the nerdiest developers that they could find. So pretty much everyone's experience, their first experience with Google Glass, was it being worn by the weirdest person they know. That is not the way you want to sell a new product that people are already a little bit worried about.
Okay. You make a really good point there. Well, let's talk about the overall fortunes of Snap, which, by the way, they just renamed themselves on Friday. They're now no longer Snapchat, they're Snap.
Yeah, that's the parent company. So Spectacles is a product of Snap. Snapchat is a product of Snap, and they might be making other things. Little do most people know, Snapchat has been secretly selling hardware products for a while, but they're not smart products. They're not technology. It's been selling ice cube trays, backpacks, pillows, beach towels, just random objects that they thought that people in their demographic would like to have at home. But it wants to really be more of a culture company, not just a product company.
Well, I had no idea you could get an ice cube tray from Snap.
Wow, yeah, I actually have one of their pillows hanging out in my room right now. The zipper on the backpack is actually the tongue, the little pink tongue that comes out of the ghost's mouth.
Okay, so back to its overall business strategy. They fended off a $3 billion offer from Facebook.
Seems very smart now.
Yeah, it does. People are like, oh, what is he doing, this 20-something-year-old? But it does seem smart now. Facebook bought Instagram. So it seems like everyone wants to get into this kind of video world, these quick videos.
Yeah, you know, now when the Instagram purchase happened for $1 billion, everyone was like, wow, I can't believe an app got bought for $1 billion. But now Instagram is valued at around $30 billion. So you could say that they sold way, way too early. And, you know, this now Snapchat looks pretty smart because they're being valued at around $16 to $20 billion. They're hoping to make a few hundred million dollars this year and maybe even $1 billion thanks to their video advertisements next year. So it doesn't look like that bad of a business. But the question is, what can Snapchat do to leverage all of that cool? You know, it's the only company that's perhaps cool enough to be able to remove the stigma that Google Glass instilled in the world.
Well, Josh, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Josh Constein is editor-at-large of TechCrunch. And Julie Myers is here now. Welcome to the week. I don't see you wearing your Snapchat spectacles.
You know, and that question just occurred to me because I am wearing my usual spectacles because I am blind almost. And do you just put the Snapchat ones over your regular?
This is for people who
have perfect eyesight.
Are younger than you and have perfect eyesight.
Point of order, I started wearing glasses when I was in third grade.
Okay.
Maybe.
You know you have an old soul.
That is absolutely true.
No, I don't think they snap onto your regular glasses,
so you would,
although that would be a good add-on.
Right. Snapsticles. Snapsticle?
That's spectacles. Whatever.
That came out wrong. Okay. Anyway, we talked about star meters on IMDb, yep. And we had an actor write in. His name is Charles Antebi, and he says that the star meter issue is completely mystifying. He says that his rating in May was about 90,000. He was an independent film that opened that week, so that's why his star meter looked like that. And then 3 weeks ago, it was 650,000, which is apparently his worst showing ever. And he says the system to him makes absolutely no sense because actors who have been in a lot fewer movies than him have a better star meter. The whole thing is completely crazy and mystifying.
Plus, it goes backwards. So one
right.
is high.
The high score, yeah,
is a
up
low
is
number.
Down and down is up. And yeah.
It's a brave new world.
Right. Just go on Snapchat, and if you get all them views and likes, that's where your validation can come from. That's how it works, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. Or Facebook,
right.
Or Twitter,
yep.
Whatever.
Yep.
Just the thumbs. All right. Julie Myers, thank you very much. And thank you for listening. Have a great afternoon. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.